to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
Weekend All Things Considered up in just a minute. First, Steve Herrera is stepping in for one last traffic report for him this afternoon with a problem now in San Francisco. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Sandy. Trouble here in San Francisco, eastbound 80 at 4th Street. There's a major motorcycle crash blocking the center lane. In Benicia, southbound 680 before Parrish Road, I see a ladder taking away the left lane. And problems in Pinole, westbound 80 before Pinole Valley Road, a solo vehicle accident on the right-hand shoulder. I'm Steve Herrera for KQED.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Have a good night. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not in most cases, and invest the funds back into our news coverage. Learn more at kqed.org/cars. I'm Sandy Altaus. Good evening, or afternoon. We're almost there. You're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 5 p.m.
Mexico has huge gaps in their history. Though returning these won't fill those gaps entirely, it will help with solving some of the missing pieces.
Why and how a Nashville museum is returning some of its long-held artifacts to Mexico. For Sunday, June 2nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, how, as far as we can tell, a criminal conviction affects a presidential campaign.
My revenge will be success, and I mean that. But it's awfully hard when you see what they've done. These people are so evil.
We'll also head to Europe to check in on this week's EU elections, and we'll look at just how different British elections are from American campaigns. Spoiler alert, they are a lot shorter. Plus, Willie Nelson is still kicking out new work at age 91.
This is one of those truly important and ultimate Nelson records.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The White House is waiting for Hamas to decide on whether they support the latest proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza. White House National Security Advisor John Kirby.
Where we are right now is that proposal, an Israeli proposal, has been given to Hamas. It was done on Thursday night, our time. We're waiting for an official response from Hamas. We would note that publicly, Hamas officials came out and welcomed this proposal. And so what would we hope would happen is they would agree to start phase one as soon as possible.
Speaking there on ABC's This Week, phase one is a six-week ceasefire, then the release of hostages and Palestinian detainees, and finally phase three would be the start of major reconstruction for Gaza. But Israel's defense minister says they won't accept a deal if Hamas is allowed to rule over Gaza after the war. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Singapore today, talking about potential security agreements as Russia makes gains in Ukraine's northeast. And here's Emily Fang has more.
Zelensky and Austin are both in Singapore for an annual security forum held in the Asian city-state's Shangri-La Hotel. Zelensky took to Twitter to share a picture of him and Austin shaking hands and said that he and Austin had declared support for Ukraine's air defense in the drafting of a new bilateral security agreement. The U.S. just changed its stance earlier this week and will now allow Ukraine to fire weapons provided by the U.S. at some targets in Russia, which has been incrementally advancing along its northeastern front in Ukraine. And Zelensky is now on a traveling spree, first going to Sweden and now Singapore to rally more support for Ukraine and for a peace forum in Switzerland later this month. I'm Emily Fang, NPR News, Singapore.
In Akron, Ohio this morning, 25 people were shot, one fatally. And in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, multiple people opened fire, killing at least two and wounding seven others. NPR's Amy Held has more.
Just after midnight Sunday in Akron, Ohio, police say a 27-year-old man was shot dead among 25 gunshot victims. Hours later, the mayor says the pain is reverberating across the city and asked for witnesses to step forward. There's no word about a suspect. Police say they removed a firearm and several dozen casings from the scene. It happened, they said, at a large gathering. Researchers who looked at 100 U.S. cities found as temperatures rise, so too do shootings, with more people getting together outdoors interpersonal disputes, a top factor in gun violence, can boil over. Outside Pittsburgh early Sunday, Allegheny County police say a fight broke out at a hookah bar and lounge where multiple people opened fire, killing a man and a woman, and leaving several people injured. Amy Held, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading in mixed territory at this hour. Dow futures are up about 0.1%. NASDAQ futures down a fraction. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman. CAL FIRE is reducing all evacuation orders related to the Corral Fire to evacuation warnings effective at 6 p.m. tonight. The fire began burning yesterday afternoon southwest of the town of Tracy in San Joaquin County. It has since burned over 14,000 acres and is 30% contained. The evacuation update is the latest signal that firefighters are gaining the upper hand in battling the blaze. The burn spread rapidly yesterday due to high winds and hot temperatures, but CAL FIRE says more favorable conditions today are allowing firefighters to make progress containing the fire. This means evacuees can return to their home. CAL FIRE advises residents to remain vigilant and be prepared for potential changes. You can find more on this story at kqed.org. About 1,400 students are hoping for another opportunity to take the SAT after a Wi-Fi problem at their testing site in Oakland prevented them from completing the exam on Saturday. Livermore High junior Emily Wagner says she started a petition to hold a makeup test at her school.
It's really important for me to be able to open up a new spot to take the test because a lot of students can't afford to travel hundreds of miles away to take the test somewhere else.
In a statement, the College Board, which runs the test, says demand is exceeding capacity for tests in the Bay Area. Saturday's test was at the Oakland Marriott City Center Hotel. The board says that it is contracting with non-traditional locations because of a shortage of institutions willing to host. The College Board says students will receive a full refund, and they're working to ensure that students can take the test again. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And by the listeners of KQED. Partly cloudy this evening, mostly cloudy overnight with temperatures in the 50s to mid-60s. Tomorrow, a lot of clouds, mostly cloudy, highs upper 50s. To 60s at the coast and low 80s inland. And then Tuesday sunny, and we're going to start seeing things heat up. We'll have a bit of a heat wave into the 80s and possibly 90s in the inland areas by midweek. 5:06.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. You have almost certainly heard by now that as of this past Thursday, former President Donald Trump is a convicted felon. This historic fact makes an already wild election cycle even more unprecedented, and it leads to a question we haven't had to ask before. What does it even look like to run for president under these circumstances? NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben is here with a look at what his campaign is up to. Hey, Danielle.
Hey, Scott.
So this past week, Trump had a lot to say. He spoke to reporters immediately after the conviction and then again at a lengthy Friday press conference. But do we have a sense broadly of what campaigning looks like right now for him?
Well, at least in the last few days, he really seems to be going for visibility after being confined to that courtroom for several weeks. He made an appearance at a UFC fight last night, and he also just joined TikTok, and his first post was a video of his entrance at that fight last night. He also just announced a Las Vegas rally next weekend, and his campaign tells me they'll be announcing more events this week. And he sat down for a very friendly interview with Fox and Friends this weekend. He was asked if he feels the need for revenge after the verdict, and here was his answer.
It's a very interesting question, and I say it and it sounds beautiful, right? You know, my revenge will be success, and I mean that. But it's awfully hard when you see what they've done. These people are so evil.
And that's really been his messaging for a long time, that he's the victim of a politicized and unfair justice system. Now, it bears repeating, there is no evidence of political bias or interference in this court case. So that's Trump. Now, as for his campaign strategy, they just announced an initiative called Trump Force 47, which is an effort that's cooperative between the campaign and the RNC, signing volunteers up to make calls, distribute signs for the campaign, that sort of thing. What you can imagine is that the campaign is really hoping to leverage whatever enthusiasm the guilty verdict stirred up in their voters.
We know that, both campaigns were using this verdict to fundraise. Do we have a sense at this point how the verdict drove donations?
Well, for Trump, we have some sense. The campaign reported that they raised nearly $53 million in the first 24 hours after the verdict. Now, that is really big. Now, this is not verified in a campaign finance report yet. It's possible, for example, that some of these donations could be refunded if some donors have given over their legal limit. And official numbers will come later this month. But even if the correct total is in that ballpark, that's huge. In all of April, for example, Trump and the GOP together raised $76 million. So 53 in 24 hours is big.
Yeah.
Now, as for the Biden camp, they told my colleague Tamara Keith that they also had strong fundraising post-verdict, but they didn't put numbers on. So we'll watch for that.
We know that there's many polls to come in the wake of this verdict. Rather than get your hot take on what they might say, I think I will instead ask you to help listeners understand what to look for, how to make sense of these polls when they start coming.
Sure. Well, first off, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are very well-known quantities. A lot of people already had their minds made up about both of those guys well before this.
Yeah.
But second of all, Trump is now a convicted felon, and it's going to stay that way. It's going to stay that way barring a successful appeal, and we'll wait to see what happens there. It's possible that this verdict, though, doesn't create just a momentary polling bump or polling dip, but that it could sway opinions in weeks down the line as more people start paying attention. Now, to me, the big question is how Biden uses this verdict. What story does he tell about it? Is this about democracy? Is this about Trump's values, his fitness for office? What we can say is that it's a close election right now. We may never know exactly what sways things, but more is going to happen. The sentencing, the conventions, the debates. There's still so much time for things to get even more unprecedented.
More unprecedented. All right. Plus three other criminal cases out there. That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
While we in the U.S. have been focused on our presidential election, and clearly there's a lot to focus on, 2024 is a huge year for elections all around the world. Half of the world's population, some 4 billion people, are voting for new leaders. Later this week, citizens of the European Union will choose a new parliament. Many of those countries are also holding national elections. The voting comes amid a continued surge of populism in Europe and all over the world. Terry Schultz joins us now from Brussels, the capital of the EU, to talk about this massive voting process. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Scott.
All right, 27 countries holding elections at the same time. This sounds like a lot.
It's a lot. It is a lot. Some 373 million people are eligible to vote this week in elections that start in some countries on Thursday, and then they'll all wrap up on Sunday. And each of them is choosing their own members of the 720-seat European Union Parliament, which is done every 5 years, with seats allocated by population, like the U.S. House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
But in some places, as we mentioned, this coincides with elections for national parliaments and governments. And for example, here in Belgium, which has a notoriously messy political system, they're electing a new national parliament, several regional parliaments, and members of the European Parliament all on the same day.
That sounds incredibly complicated.
It is complicated, but it's also really important when you consider that after June 9th, you'll have a new EU legislature in addition to these new governments in some EU countries, and any of these can single-handedly block proposals at the EU level due to the need for consensus. So it's fair to say that in a week, the political landscape in Europe could look a whole lot different.
As best as you can, because I'm sure there's different issues in different places, what are some of the common themes that we are seeing across the EU here?
Yes, there are specific country topics that are important, but when it comes to areas where policies are made at the level of the EU and then will apply to the member countries, that's particularly important in things like budgets, how the common money is spent, or sharing the number of undocumented migrants who need to be resettled as a particularly thorny example.
Is that a key issue in Europe right now? Because it's obviously a key issue here in the U.S. in our upcoming election.
It is. It's very, very divisive here in Europe. And also similar to the U.S., policy over Russia's war on Ukraine is driving a lot of the election debate. And that's because many decisions on help for Ukraine are, as I explained, made at the EU level. And there have been some big changes in the last couple of years. For example, allowing money from the joint EU budget to be used to support Ukraine militarily, that wasn't even possible 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
EU policy on climate is up there, too, as well as agricultural support and attitudes toward toward China. And as we mentioned, and sort of hanging over all these issues, is this shift in voter support for the far right, which is seen across the block.
Let's talk more about that. Do we have a sense whether more far right leaders could be elected to parliament?
Absolutely. The polls are showing that there will be even a surge, as it's often described, in support for these far-right parties. And there's particular concern about some polls showing that the youth vote is significantly moving to the right. Hmm. Now, the two largest political groups of lawmakers in Parliament, that's the center-right European People's Party and the Socialists, they'll comfortably remain the two largest group. But the Greens, which 5 years ago benefited from young voters, and other left-leaning parties are clearly set to lose seats to the right. And there have already been some far-right and populist governments elected in some European countries, which just reinforces that forecast. And until now, it's mainly been Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, who blocks initiatives such as aid for Ukraine or solidarity in resettling asylum seekers. But he may well have more company after these elections.
In the little time we have left, what's the sense of what turnout could be?
Well, some countries require their citizens to vote, so that certainly helps get people to the polls. But I just checked statistics, and last time, in 2019, it was just 50% turnout across the 27 countries. There's been a lot of campaigning, especially with these pro-EU candidates possibly in trouble. So there's a lot of concern about this, and also about how disinformation may affect the vote at the last minute. So it will be interesting to see how participation figures pan out.
Terry Schultz, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This week, President Biden and other world leaders will gather in France to mark the 80th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, that moment when the U.S. and its allies began to free France and Western Europe from Nazi occupation. 80 years means a lot of the men who took the beaches on D-Day are now gone, but not all of them. A handful of World War II veterans will be there. They arrived in Paris this weekend, as Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Cheers resounded in Terminal 2C of Charles de Gaulle Airport as 66 World War II veterans were wheeled from the plane one by one. The welcoming crowd waved French and American flags. Many held pictures of the men and a few women taken some 80 years ago. Despite the passage of time, Frenchman Frédéric Nancel recognizes the soldier in the picture he's holding and approaches him.
Oh, this is you.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
David Yoho says he's thrilled to be back. A D-Day veteran who lied about his age to get into the war, he's one of the few veterans who walked off the plane.
Listen, we're glad to be alive. Average guy's pretty close to 100.
How old are you?
96. I'm the youngest on the flight. I went in at 15, falsified.
Yeah. Oh, it's wonderful to be back. We did a great job.
102-year-old Ralph Goldsticker is accompanied by his 73-year-old son, Larry, who pushes his wheelchair.
My grandmother saved every letter that he wrote, 500 letters, that I got to read. You know, so you look at your father as kind of a guy, an idol-like figure, and realize these are boys. He was 21 years old when they're doing this.
Bill Wall was a 21-year-old gunner on a B-24 bomber that flew above the landing beaches. He says he lost some of his dearest friends.
It was just like sitting ducks. Young guys scared to death, no protection, and landing crafts, and some of them seasick, and they were just slaughtered.
My name is Lewis Brown, and I'm 98 years old.
Brown was part of the Red Ball Express, the famous convoy system that transported supplies from the beaches to the troops in record time. It's his first time back.
I know everything is different now than what it was when I was there. Everything was just torn up. I don't remember no pretty airport like this.
Welcome back to France.
American ambassador to France, Denise Campbell Bauer, lauded what she called the greatest generation. A school group sang the French and American national anthems. These veterans will be the guests of honor in celebrations all week along the beaches of Normandy. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. and European Sleepworks, a store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Coming up on the Sunday Music Drop, we're going to hear the song Things Can't Go On Like This Forever from San Francisco dance music producer Chrissy. He'll be performing at Mothership Bar in San Francisco on June 22nd. The Sunday Music Drop, that's our series on local musicians with upcoming shows, and you can hear it at 5:35.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Police in Akron, Ohio are searching for the gunman who opened fire at a street party early this morning, leaving one person dead and more than two dozen injured. No arrests have been made and a motive hasn't been disclosed. It's Election Day in Mexico, and this one's a historic one, with more than 20,000 positions up for grabs, including the presidency, both houses of Congress, and local officials. But the election has been marred by violence. Officials say at least 37 candidates have been killed while campaigning. And at the weekend box office, it was a quiet one. Sony's animated The Garfield movie took the top spot with an estimated $14 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism. Available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org. Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And by the listeners of KQED. Good afternoon. It's 5:20. I'm Sandy Althaus. Thanks for being here on this Sunday afternoon.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It was Bonnie Seymour's first day on the job at the Nashville Parthenon. Yep, it's a replica of the real thing. She was taking a tour of the museum's collection when behind a set of purple doors, she came upon hundreds of pre-Columbian artifacts.
A lot of arrowheads made out of different materials, especially obsidian. Hand tools like axes. I have a grinding stone.
Immediately, Seymour knew what she had to do.
And my first thought, just looking at it, was just like, well, this can't stay here. This has to go back home.
Seymour is the registrar and assistant curator at the Nashville Parthenon's museum. Since she started the job a little over 2 years ago, she has been on a mission to return the museum's pre-Columbian collection back to Mexico. I asked her why it was so important for her to send the artifacts back.
Because they're somebody's history. They represent someone's ancestors, and we're not them. Mexico has a history of people taking their things, and they have huge gaps in their history. And though returning these won't fill those gaps entirely, it will help with, I don't know, assuaging bad feelings and hopefully solving some of the missing pieces.
You know, one thing I was looking forward to asking you is that this is a story that's been playing out over several years all over the world, museums large and small. And I think one of the thoughts that a lot of people have is, I remember going to this museum or that museum, and I remember seeing these exhibits and learning a lot about this culture and feeling like I learned something and I knew something about them, and that opportunity goes away. What is your response when somebody pushes back against this idea, talking about something like that?
Well, that is a very hard question. I want people to be able to see these cultures and learn about them, but I also don't think that we should keep things from people when they want them back. A lot of times, these items get to museums in unethical manners, and that needs to be examined. But each case of repatriation is different. There's so many pitfalls in each one, but there needs to be compromise and collaboration and discussion. Overall, these pieces belong to the globe, mm-hmm. but they are individual pieces representing an individual culture. And yes, we have buy-in as a visitor, but they have emotional and historical buy-in.
Have you gotten any criticism from around Tennessee for this move?
No.
No.
Surprisingly. I was kind of expecting some kind of how could you do this? This is ours. We should keep it, you know, whatever. And it's been totally positive, supportive, happy. I've had people come in and cry when they see it. So it's been great.
The items, before their return, there's a special exhibit about mm-hmm. this process, all about the items. The exhibition is titled Repatriation and Its Impact. Can you tell me how you decided on that title, what you're hoping people walk into this thinking about?
I want people to come in and know exactly that this is about not just our collection, but the world. I want to introduce them to the idea of what repatriation is, and that it's not an abstract idea, that it is something that impacts people on a personal level, but it also impacts government and politics and law. But I didn't want to overload people either, so I just picked the name because it was the simplest way of getting at that. And then the exhibit is a way to introduce the idea and get people talking. Instead of just hearing the headlines on the news, which can be quite negative, and let them know that, you know, museums aren't evil and they're not trying to keep people's stuff away from them. They really are trying to work this out. It's mm-hmm. just messy. And I also wanted to make sure that they knew that these artifacts that I have do connect to a living, breathing, thriving culture. So that's when I brought in Jose Vera and his art. And it's been a great reflection of the ancient and the modern. And it's doing really well.
You mentioned the work of a contemporary artist, Jose Vera. Can you explain how that fits into the exhibition?
So his work is very eclectic and very mixed media. And he himself is originally from the same area of Western Mexico as the artifacts, which was happy coincidence, actually. And he's a local Mexican artist here. He does a lot of murals, and his work is very personal as well. And he brings in elements of his history and his culture into it. So the pieces that he put up represent the people of Mexico. So he's got one I really like that is called The Founder, which is the supposed to represent the founder of the Aztec people. So it's this gold and brown and black with glitter and all kinds of stuff and feathers everywhere. And it's huge and it's great and it's beautiful. There's 3D elements like 3D printed dragons or serpents that he's put on his pieces. And they all kind of reflect the people that represent the artifacts. So it's been a really good modern and ancient combination.
Can you spell out specifically who the items are being returned to and if you know what their plans are yet?
Yes. I can tell you who they're going to. They're going to the Mexican Institute of Anthropology and Archaeology. And the plan so far is that the Atlanta consulate's going to come pick them up from us and then at some point bring them to them. And then after that, I don't know. That's the one thing about repatriating something. Once it's out of your hands, it's out of your hands. Mm-hmm. You have no control over what happens.
Is there any flip side feeling to that? Like, obviously you want to do this. You feel very mm-hmm. passionately about this. Is there any feeling of like, this is not my responsibility anymore?
Well, it's like, in a way I'm really happy they're going, but in a way it's like, they're kind of like my friends. Yeah. And I want them to have a good life once they leave. So I'm hoping that they will be taken care of, but it's really their responsibility at that point. I don't want to be like a helicopter mom to these artifacts, but yeah, I'd like to know what are you gonna do, and you know, let me know how they're doing, that kind of thing. Like, just check in.
Is there one artifact that you have grown most close to or appreciate the most that you're just gonna be, even if you know this is the right thing to do, sad to see go?
Yes, it's the Xolo dog. He's like this kind of a basketball sized fat dog with a grin on his face, and he's still got dirt in his mouth from when he was excavated.
Wow.
Yeah, I've put him on like kind of a special thing in the center, so he's greeting people when they come in. But one thing we're trying to do is try to get two or three pieces 3D printed so that they still have a connection to the people here in community in Nashville, because it's also part of our history now too. So it'd be nice to have them for educational purposes. And that piece is the one I want to get 3D printed the most, so he'll still kind of be here in spirit.
It's Bonnie Seymour. She's the registrar and assistant curator of the museum at the Nashville Parthenon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the U.S. election and the upcoming European Union parliamentary elections. We're now going to turn to another election, the British elections, happening a little more than a month from now. Conservatives have led the UK for more than a decade, but polls show the party has a good chance of being booted from power. There are historically a lot of similarities between British and American politics, but there are also some really big differences. I talked about them with Frank Langfitt, who spent years as NPR's London correspondent and now covers global democracy for the network. In our conversation, Langfitt said one major difference is that campaigning in the UK only lasts 6 weeks.
And I got to say, as somebody who has covered American elections many years ago and covered seemingly countless UK elections, it's nice to have it truncated like that. You can talk about, I mean, they can talk about all kinds of issues in the UK, and then it's the final 6 weeks. And also a huge difference is there's nowhere near the money that you have here in the United States. So the kind of coverage that we're doing now, 5 months out, It doesn't happen in the United Kingdom. People focus in the final 6 weeks. Everybody goes to the polls, and then that's that.
What are some of the specifics as a reporter that you've seen that are different from a British election compared to an American election in terms of how they campaign, in terms of what campaign events are like, just the tenor and tone of it?
Yeah, it's much smaller. They're on TV. It's a much smaller country, so it's very easy to move about. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I could get on a train or I could get in my car and cover things in the north of England with no trouble. I could go up to Scotland. So it's a much easier country to cover. I think in terms of other differences, it is nowhere near as polarized as the United States, and it's vitriolic. Mm-hmm. And I was there when it was the most chaotic period since the end of the war, because of Brexit, and still it didn't have that level of venom that we see in the United States. And the other thing that's interesting, Scott, is the United States has an outsized influence on the UK because of history and shared language. So often, you know, Tony Blair is a great example. They've followed some of the formulas that they see in the United States. A very good example would be Tony Blair doing his third way, which was following very much Bill Clinton kind of model.
I mean, even at the height of the Brexit tension, because it was the Brexit referendum, right, where a member of parliament was killed.
That's true. I still don't think it's as vitriolic as what we see here. There's a really big difference coming back to the United States. I've been gone for many, many years. And in the UK, it was not that hard to talk politics. I had neighbors who were quite conservative, who were Brexit voters, and we had a variety of thoughts. But you could talk to them about things. And here I come back to the United States. I moved into a new neighborhood, and it is very different. We had a cocktail party where we invited the whole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It was okay. And then we realized that actually we're going to have discrete parties or discrete groups of people because some people don't want to be at the same party as other people because the political differences are so profound. Now, you're used to this because you've lived in America, you cover politics. I left in 2010. I left in the first Obama administration. That was not the case in the United States.
Why do you think that the walls are a little lower in other countries like Britain? Is it that it's multiple parties? Is it that it's not a presidential system? Is it that there's just a lot less money and effort made into making it a divisive scenario?
One thing is there's a shared sense of reality in the United Kingdom, and there's not a shared sense of facts in this country. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, as you remember, I was covering Boris Johnson when he was in deep, deep trouble because his administration had been holding parties during COVID lockdown.
Lockdowns that were much more severe than American
much more
lockdowns.
Severe than the ones that you had in the United States. This infuriated everybody across the board. So even though you have a partisan press in the UK, the Daily Mail was saying this is, you know, the Daily Mail, for our listeners, they're a very conservative tabloid. Mm-hmm. They were saying this is unacceptable. And so what was really interesting in the UK is there was no newspaper or news organization that tried to spread disinformation to say, oh, Boris is cool, he always tells the truth. Everybody knew that Boris Johnson was a habitual liar.
Right.
And so that's not the case in America. And so that's why you can have these conversations, because you're not trying to talk to someone and convince them of a fact. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew that. Even my next door neighbor, who were Brexit voters, who were classic Tories in the suburbs of London, they knew who Boris Johnson was. That to me is a fundamental difference.
So we've been talking about differences between the British system and the American system. Much shorter election season.
Much.
You think a lot less
partisan in a way that you can actually have conversations. There's shared reality. But you and I have talked a lot over the years about similarities in moments in British and American politics, where you kind of see waves that, yeah, that have similar trends in the countries. So from your perspective, what do you think is at stake in this upcoming election that might tell us something about what we might be in store for in the United States?
This is a question that makes me sad. I'll just be honest with you. But some of the malaise and division that we see in the United Kingdom, I worry if that's a little bit of the ghost of Christmas future.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to get things done. It's a country that doesn't seem to have great direction. It has been polarized over economic issues, over immigration, some very familiar issues.
How many prime ministers did you roll through when you were covering?
I want to say it was five.
Yeah.
And I missed Liz Truss because I was in covering the war in Ukraine, so I think I got a week of Liz Truss because she wasn't there very long.
It's like half her tenure.
Yeah. And so I worry a little bit about that because I do see some similarities. And I do want to say, as we were talking, it is very polarized.
Yeah.
But it's not anywhere near as bad as what I've encountered coming back to the United States.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. He spent several years as our London correspondent and is now our global democracy correspondent. This is NPR News.
This is the Sunday Music Drop from KQED News on the weekend. I'm Annalise Finney. Each week, we bring you a new song from an artist who calls the Bay Area home. This song comes to us from San Francisco's Chrissy.
Hi, my name's Chrissy. I'm a musician, DJ, producer, etc., living in San Francisco. And this song is Things Can't Go On Like This Forever by me and Carrie Wilds. Dance music that is kind of in the realm of house music, rave music, techno, things like that. So maybe just like fun party music. I grew up in Kansas City and certainly didn't feel accepted as not a super heteronormative, gender-conforming person out in the world. The dance music scene has always felt like a little bit of a refuge, and you don't necessarily like have to do that drag of normalcy that you have to do to get along out in the real world. I think on the outside, it sounds really happy and joyous. There's maybe two messages to it. One is like everything's impermanent and we'll get through this. The other message is maybe we won't get through this and we're kidding ourselves, but we're so small and insignificant that maybe that doesn't matter. Like in terms of like climate change, for instance. Like, maybe we'll fix this and humanity will survive. Or maybe we won't and we'll all die. And, like, you know, dolphins aren't going to care. They're going to be fine without us. And maybe that's okay, too. It's either really optimistic or really depressing, depending on how you want to read it.
That was DJ and producer Chrissy talking about the song Things Can't Go On Like This Forever, featuring Carrie Wilds. If you'd like to hear Chrissy live, he'll be performing at Mothership Bar in San Francisco on June 22nd. To hear past episodes of the Sunday Music Drop, check out kqed.org/Sunday Music Drop. I'm Annalise Finney, and this is KQED News on the Weekend.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, my conversation with Robert Santos, the first Latino appointed as director of the U.S. Census Bureau.
I do not view this as an issue of look what's happened in the past. I view it as where do we need to get into the future?
That's this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA coming up next at 6, followed at 7 by Hidden Brain.
In 1989, the city of San Francisco tore down a massive double-decker highway called the Embarcadero Freeway.
When it was removed, they got the waterfront back. They saw an increase in housing, increase in jobs. It's one of the most visited places in the world, and it's obvious why it shouldn't be covered with a freeway.
The surprising benefits of subtraction this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Singapore, discussing a potential security agreement as Russia makes gains in Ukraine's northeast. Meanwhile, emergency power shutdowns are in effect in most of Ukraine, a day after Russia unleashed large-scale attacks on energy infrastructure in that country. And in California, firefighters say calmer winds are helping them battle the Corral Fire, about 50 miles east of San Francisco, that started yesterday and has already burned through 14,000 acres. It's 30% contained, and the cause of the fire is still under investigation. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sattva. Sattva has 9 made-to-order mattresses that are designed to help every type of sleeper. Learn more at sattva.com. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners of KQED. Partly cloudy this evening, mostly cloudy overnight, and temperatures in the 50s to mid-60s.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Country singer Willie Nelson recently put out his 75th solo studio album. It's called The Border. Coming up, a country music writer tells us why he counts it among Nelson's most important albums. But first, Grammy Award-winning producer Jack Antonoff has seemingly cracked the code for making hit albums. Most recently, he worked with Taylor Swift on the Tortured Poets Department, which has spent the last 5 weeks on the top of the Billboard album charts. He's also worked with Lorde, Lana Del Rey, St. Vincent, and many others. But when it comes to his own music, like his most recent self-titled album with his band Bleachers, he says the writing process is more murky.
You don't write a lot of things you know because they're a little boring. You write a lot of things that you're unsure of.
What Antonoff has been unsure of lately has to do with a tragedy at the core of his life. He lost his sister when he was young. At this point, he has a lot to be happy about. He's gotten married. He's collaborating with artists he loves. And so there's been this question eating at him.
I was unsure of how to move on, how to live in any sort of present way. And does that mean I'm giving up on her memory or something?
Learning to make peace with that grief is just one of the many things that came up when he joined my colleague Rachel Martin for a game of Wild Card, NPR's new show where guests choose questions at random from a deck of cards, questions that get to the heart of how they make sense of the world. Here's Rachel.
All right, round one. This is Memories. Pick a card, 1 through 3.
3.
What is something about your hometown you've come to appreciate over time?
Oh, everything.
Softball! Lover of New Jersey.
Okay, real answer, though, is the slowness of my hometown. I grew up in New Milford, New Jersey. That's where I was until I was like 8, and I just stared at the walls. all I wanted to do was break out. All I wanted to do was go everywhere and do everything and tour the world and, you know, make my mark and do all these things. And that slow boredom of where I grew up made my imagination run wild. And I can't recreate it, and I can't change it, and I never would, and I'm just happy I got to have it. My life existed in cars waiting for my mom to do whatever she was doing.
I know. My kids today are like, like, come on an errand with me. No, errands? I'm like, you have no idea. That's all we used to do. We used to go on errands and sit in the car and wait for our parents. Okay, we're in round two now. This is insights, lessons that you've learned or stuff you're still figuring out. Pick a card, 1 through 3.
Two.
What is proof that somebody really knows you?
Proof that somebody really knows me is if they understand my rituals around feeling clean.
Oh, so many follow-ups to ask.
Yeah,
you.
and it's not basic. Like, it's not like he's a germaphobe. It's very specific of my definition of what is and isn't clean.
Okay, tell me an example of what that looks like for you.
My only concern with cleanliness is around my face.
Okay.
You can smear anything on my body. It's my, I haven't touched my eyes, nose, mouth, or ears with my hands unwashed in probably 20 years. So it's so,
wait, I just,
it's very specific.
But how is that even possible? I realized as you were talking, I was like rubbing underneath my eyes. I think
I don't
I touched
do it because it's very, I'm very scientific. I'm not a germaphobe. I just, that's how you get sick. That's how germs spread usually. It's not to say I go play in front of a ton of people, but I have no need to rub my eyes, my nose, my mouth, and my hands if they're not washed.
So you don't pick, if you have like a zit or like a little scab on your face, do you, you don't feel inclined to pick those things?
Well, if I do, it would be like after I've washed my hands, after
right,
a shower
okay.
or something
okay,
like that.
Okay,
like,
okay.
You know, you look around, you're at a bus stop, a restaurant, anywhere you are, and people are just touching their nose, touching their eyes, and it's like, this is how it's all happening. And there's no upside besides, you know, for me personally.
Have you always been like that? Like as a kid?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so we are now in round three. This is the beliefs round. Pick a card, 1 through 3.
1.
How has grief shaped your life?
Entirely.
Entirely.
I feel like you have these things in your life. I almost see it as like an emotional lens, you know, like a contact lens or something that like goes over your eye emotionally. And it's just sort of like, it's not like a thing that happened that you sometimes feel. It's like, it's how you see things now.
Mm-hmm.
So like grief is just like, and I assume it'll be the rest of my life, it's just part of how I see things.
How old were you when your sister died?
I was 18, but she was sick since I was 5. So it was a big part of my life.
So how does that manifest in how you see the world? In my life, I can understand that I don't have that kind of grief that's lived with me for that long, like all of your adult life and most of your childhood. But does it, I mean, for me, I see a kind of constant impermanence in things.
Yeah.
Is that how it shows up in your life when you
it's
say
one,
it shapes
yeah,
everything about it?
I think that things are really fleeting. You know, the thing about sick people who are unsure how long they'll get to live, especially kids in that position, I mean, the lack of cynicism, the obsession with creation, joy, love, family, you know, it's just when you might not have a lot of time on earth, you don't define yourself by the things you hate, put very simply. And so that just lives in me. You know, I'm not someone who moves through the world. I'm not really doing a bit, you know, I'm really feel very sincere about the things I'm doing and saying. And I think a big part of that is just being confronted with time and fragility. And yeah, that was always on the table, especially like when she actually died, you know, she was dying and actually died when I was 18. So, and then the years before, obviously, were pretty tough. So it's like, it was a pretty powerful life moments. I remember very clearly seeing everyone in my world kind of like planes taking off. And I was not, you know, that's a very specific moment in time when you're supposed to feel like free and
like
anything's possible.
Yeah.
Well, said that, you know, most people, you're graduating high school. That's the moment when you're supposed to be like, I can do anything in the world.
Right.
The you know, those are really those, as I've heard, because I didn't really have them, those few years you get where you're just sort of like endless stamina, endless possibility.
Yeah.
You know, those are the years that everyone talks about. I didn't really get them in the same way. I think that colored my life a lot.
How do you feel most connected to her?
Probably through my family. That's why we, you know, I think when you have a great loss, people either kind of like run or glue themselves to each other. Mm-hmm. We definitely did the glue method.
Jack Antonoff, award-winning musician, songwriter, producer. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
You can hear a longer version of this conversation with Jack Antonoff by listening to the podcast Wildcard with Rachel Martin. Willie Nelson has just released his 75th solo album. And yes, you heard that right, 75th. This latest album is called The Border. And at 91 years old, you might forgive Nelson if he just phoned this one in. But that is not what he did at all.
And you tell me that you wish that you never heard of me. Then you close your eyes. I'm not the one you see. Well, kiss me when you're through.
Here to talk about Nelson's newest effort is the Tennessean's Nashville country music reporter, Marcus Dowling. Marcus, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Willie sounded really good at 91.
Absolutely. Well, he's still a contemporary country artist. I mean, with the road show and with numerous other projects, he's still regularly touring, and he is cognizant of all of the artists who are releasing country records right now. They all reference him as a favorite artist, and, you know, he has his favorites as well. So he is just as contemporary as any other, you know, authentic roots-based country artist right now.
I said 75 solo albums. If you count collaborations, he's at double that number. And as we mentioned, he's 91 years old. What does Willie Nelson have to say on this latest album?
He's saying that there is value in the accrued intelligence that time allows you to garner. I think that's the most important part of this record, is that, you know, he's 91 years old, so he's seen everything twice and forgotten half of it.
Yeah.
So I think there's a value in him offering to the world that he's a person of intellect, and that has value, I think, to all of the conversations that we're having, both in modern music and also in modern society.
Mm-hmm. A lot of conversations about that, and I think a lot of people do feel like older people are discounted in a lot of different ways, so that's an interesting point of view to be hearing.
Though every storm, when I've been weak, promises I fail to speak. Day to day, the dreams denied, the truth I've told and the times I've lied. Nobody knows me. Nobody knows me like you.
One of the songs that jumped out to both of us, it's called Nobody Knows Me Like You. Tell me what that's about and how it fits into this theme we're talking about.
Well, it's about his wife. He's been with his wife, Annie, for quite some time, and they've been through a lot. You know, he went through a financial issue, a bankruptcy. He went through numerous health concerns, and she stood by his side. She was, you know, an intrinsic part of his life and helped him, you know, survive all of that. Being 91 and being able to reflect on that is important, because obviously in country music, there are songs about marriages and songs about divorces and songs about losing partners and gaining partners and falling in and out of love. But to reflect the longevity of staying with the same person and the positives and negatives of that, I think that that's truly impactful.
Nobody knows me like you.
There is the sustained moment of country being at the front and center of pop culture and music right now, and all these interesting crossovers and blending with hip-hop, among other genres. How do you sort Willie Nelson into that scene? What can you point to in current country music and say that is a direct descendant of what Willie Nelson has been doing for decades?
all the Red Dirt stuff is popping off right now. If you look at like the Wyatt Flores of the world, if you look at Caitlin Butts, like there's just artists. If you go from Austin to Dallas up to Oklahoma City and Tulsa, like anybody who's in that through line right now, like if you ask them point blank, where is Willie Nelson in their sound, they could point to at least five things that are obviously a clear homage to, you know, a 91-year-old artist who's made 150 albums.
What's your personal favorite part of his sound?
It's the honesty. It's there's something about the ability as a songwriter first. Like Willie Nelson's career is intrinsically based within this songwriter tradition. He wrote Crazy for Patsy Cline. So he gets it. And then when you look at the back half of that career in Austin, in that scene in the 70s, where he is able to dive in and work as a song stylist and as a guitar player and blending those things together. It's all honest.
Let's get to the title track of this new album, The Border.
Where the smugglers do business, that's where I make a stand. I know this old desert like the back of my hand.
So this is a song that was written a while ago, but this album is coming out at a time when the border is this intensely political topic. It's dominating the upcoming election, and it's something that depending on your point of view, you have a wildly different understanding of the basic facts of the situation. And Willie Nelson is making this decision to not just put this song on this album, but to make it the title of the album as a whole, to really center this narrative. And it's a narrative about one particular person and his story. What do you think he's trying to do here?
I think that it's a fascinating story, this song. So Rodney Crowell wrote it 20 years ago. Rodney Crowell, who is a 70s and 80s country icon. He wrote it about a time in American history in the early 2000s where the Nuevo Laredo border was in crisis. But I think the spin of it, of diving directly into the border agent, is the fascinating part.
I come home to Maria in a bulletproof vest with the weight of the whole wide world bearing down on my chest.
In reducing this, and not in a negative way, but in an honest way, to a person who carries the weight of the world, in some cases, literally on their shoulders every day, and having to make decisions that, on both sides of the political axis, are either frustrating or lauded. And there's a lot there, yes, to unpack, but I think that's the point, is that it's presented so flatly and so well by Nelson that in many cases the topics unpack themselves here. Mm-hmm. And we get the flattest conversation about border politics in modern culture that we've ever had.
Given that, and given, again, 75 solo albums, how do you place this latest one, The Border, in his catalog, in his body of work?
To me, it falls, if you would have placed it in the era of like the late 70s Nelson albums, so this will be after Redheaded Stranger and somewhere after Stardust, before the 80s pop cultural boom kind of like handles his career with Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys and so on and so forth. Like, it's right in there. This is one of those truly important and ultimate Nelson records.
It's Marcus Dowling, Nashville country music reporter for the Tennessean. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Willie Nelson's new album is called The Border.
How much does it cost to be free? Free from the heartache, still living in.
That's all things considered from NPR News. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE, price and coverage match limited by state law, and by the listeners of KQED. Joe Salvatore is here with some evening traffic, and we're starting with a problem in Redwood City. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sandy. This is southbound 101, just north of Woodside Road. This is a solo crash in which a vehicle flipped over, landed on the right shoulder, ended up in a ravine. Emergency crews are still blocking the right lane. Traffic is stop and go from Whipple Avenue. And in Tracy, we still have one lane closed, all due to the